You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about how the Appleton International Airport is growing some of its produce for its eatery in the airport itself. Now, for the fourth time in our country's history, the gray wolf has been removed from the endangered species list. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service made the announcement last week, takes effect on January 2nd. The move means states regain the authority to manage the wolves. These wild animals were devastated across the lower 48 states, but they began to rebound as authorities enacted new protections, including the Endangered Species Act in 1973. In 2020, Wisconsin's population is an estimated 1,200 wolves, and with federal restrictions off, the state DNR could hold a wolf hunt. What would you like to see happen? There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Do you support or oppose a public wolf hunt? Are wolves a problem where you live? Do you think we need to respect them? 800-642-1234 is the number to call here on Central Time. Our guest is Paul Smith. He's the outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Paul, nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Kaylee. Good to talk to you.
This is not really much of a surprise, is it?
It is not a surprise. As you mentioned, they've been delisted before, and this current delisting effort started more than a year ago when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service began developing this rule. And they held a long public input process, collected comments from the public, put this plan out for peer review. And many people expected the announcement to be made many months ago, but it came down last Thursday, and it is big news, even if it isn't a surprise, because it intends to give management for this charismatic and complex and in some cases problematic animal back to states.
And when we say states get to manage wolf populations, what do we actually mean by that?
Yeah, this means, in our case, it's the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources will be charged with the management of the species. And what this now allows is lethal control. So agents either with the DNR or the U.S. Department of Agriculture and others could kill a wolf if it, for instance, were causing a problem at a farm or a livestock operation, if it were preying on calves or lambs or other animals. Normally, that would be done by trapping. They would trap the animal around that facility and then kill it. And it also would allow a state such as Wisconsin to hold a hunting and trapping season. Wisconsin did that in the last period of delisting. So from 2012 through 2014, Wisconsin had a hunting and trapping season. Our state legislature has written that into state law. So in a period of delisting, it is not optional for Wisconsin. Our DNR is required to hold something that is referred to as a public harvest season for wolves.
We are talking about the fact that the gray wolf is coming off the endangered species list, and we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Cindy from Appleton is ready to join the conversation. Good afternoon, Cindy.
Hello. Well, I am just totally disgusted to hear about this. I just cannot believe it. We are in the midst of a pandemic. We are in the midst of a depression. Unemployment is crawling up. People are losing homes. And the best these idiot Republicans can come up with is legislation to delist the wolves. I mean, what have these poor wolves done to deserve this? And I just can't believe that we're even talking about this in these times.
Cindy, thanks for the call. And I know she used some strong language about Republicans there. It's not just Republicans who are interested in doing this. So I would definitely want to point that out. And as we're talking, Paul, what exactly does delisting say about the health of a species population?
Well, the health of the wolf in Wisconsin is very good. It really is a remarkable story. When we consider this population now of more than 1,000. In fact, this year, the population estimate you referenced of greater than 1,000 is the first time in this in the last 100 years likely that the population has been that high. This animal was subject to government-sanctioned bounties that sought to exterminate this animal. From the middle 1800s all the way to 1957, in Wisconsin, a bounty was in place until 1957. The last wild wolf was found dead in Wisconsin in 1958. And the only wolves that remained in the lower 48 states were in a core area of northern Minnesota. Once some additional protections were put in place, especially the 1973 Endangered Species Act, which is the center now of this controversy, wolves began to increase in number and spread out, and some individuals eventually drifted back into Wisconsin, it's thought, in the 1970s. And that population has increased. I have written sometimes that if your financial investments had performed similar to the wolf increase, you'd be a very happy person because the graph goes basically up and up and up. The only dip in it was in that period from 2012 to 2014 when Wisconsin had the hunting and trapping season. So it dropped down. And now since December of 2014, when a federal judge ruled that they should be put back on the endangered species list, the population has further increased. So this species is showing, even biologists, it's defied the expectations of most wolf biologists with its the number of wolves and the distribution in the state. So the species is doing well. The challenge now is how do you manage this species and how many wolves should there be and what types of control should be in place?
Yeah, and that decision will now be up to states then. Paul Smith is the outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're talking about how federal protections for the gray wolf are soon gone and what that means for Wisconsin as leaders here manage the population. You're part of the conversation at 800-642-1234. Mark from Hancock is on the line. Hey, Mark.
I would like to ask, ecosystems and animals and stuff pretty much take care of themselves. But here in Wisconsin, we don't have a predator for a wolf. And although I don't believe wolf extinction is the answer, I do believe it needs to be managed. And I would like the guests to just talk about other areas. What is a predator to a wolf in other areas?
Sure. Thanks, Mark. We appreciate that call. Paul, really looking at the wolf, not in isolation, but as part of this greater system.
Yeah. The wolf is referred to as an apex predator, meaning it is at the top. It does live in areas like Alaska where there are grizzly bears. And in the Yellowstone ecosystem also, in the West, these apex predators typically avoid each other. So in Wisconsin, unless it's a pup, no wild animal is really going to prey on it. They will kill other animals. And mostly in Wisconsin, they'll eat white-tailed deer, and they also will prey on beavers and smaller mammals. But humans are the leading cause of mortality for wolves in Wisconsin. And that's through both vehicle collisions, that's through illegal killings. If the wolf is delisted as it is planned to do, the rule should take effect in January. Humans will also be controlling numbers through lethal means around farms where they're causing depredation and perhaps in a hunting and trapping season this year. And if not this year, then in the coming season.
And we've got a question that relates to that lethal force there. Linda from Appleton is ready to talk with us. Hey, Linda.
Hi. You're just wondering, are there humane ways of trapping? You know, you hear about how a wolf would chew off its own paw to get away, and that's just heartbreaking.
Thanks for the question, Linda. So Paul, beyond having to kill the animal, do we have other ways that the Wisconsin DNR people can control wolves?
They can. The leg hold trap that is used now is such that they're called offset jaws, and an animal can be trapped. It's the same trap that would be used by trappers that want to kill the wolf and as part of a public harvest season. That same trap is used by researchers to capture an animal and then sedate it and put a radio collar on it and release it. The way that holds the leg does not injure the animal. And trappers are required to check their traps at a regular basis. So there are humane ways to capture wolves, and researchers do it all the time to attach tracking devices and do other work. So, yes, the answer to the question is there are ways. However, the population now in Wisconsin is sufficiently high that around a farm or a livestock operation where wolves are causing problems, the standard course of action would be to kill an animal that's been causing problems.
We're talking about the removal of the gray wolf from the federal endangered species list. Paul Smith is our guest. He's outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You're part of this conversation. Email your question, your experience to ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues here on Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking about the gray wolf coming off of the endangered species list on January 2nd, and then states will begin managing wolf populations. Paul Smith is our guest. He's outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're taking your calls, your experiences at 800-642-1234. We've got Jeff from Highland on the phone. Hi, Jeff.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm very thankful to hear that they are finally removed from the list. Nothing personally has happened, but locally there has been wolves preying on beef cattle, livestock, eating cows alive while they're having calves, eating calves before they're even 100% born, as well as hearing of lots of cases out west from hunters and stuff. With wolves. So it's very, very, very good news to hear that the wolves are finally taken off of the list and put back into the control of farmers and those who are trying to manage what they do have and take care of it, and as well as control humane treatment of animals so the wild animals are not destroying our farm animals.
Yeah, Jeff, thanks for sharing your experience as a farmer. Want to go to Lexi in Elkhorn now. Hi, Lexi.
Hello. Hi. Yeah, this is Lexi. And I'm going to provide a little different perspective from Jeff there. I'm just really saddened and sickened and disappointed in this delisting for a lot of reasons. I've been paying attention over the years to the back and forth delisting, not delisting. And it just seems like a really sad, counterproductive cycle that we delist them and then spend money and effort and bringing back the population and then to decimate it again. It just seems like a sad cycle. So I'm really sad and disappointed by this delisting. But I have just a couple questions for the guests. It seemed like a couple of years ago there was news of, and I'm driving, so unfortunately I can't get the source in front of me, but there was news that it was one farmer in northern Wisconsin who was responsible for most of the killings of calves and livestock and stuff. So I'm wondering, if we delist them, are there any rules for farmers to be responsible and not leave out dead livestock to kind of bait the wolves and stuff? Because that causes a lot of problems. I know in northern Wisconsin and Minnesota and out west and stuff, are there, if we're going to delist them, is there any any guidelines for farmers to be responsible or ranchers? And so, yeah, so that's my question. Thank you.
Lexi, thanks for the question. Paul Smith, guidelines.
Yeah. Well, the ranchers and farmers certainly don't want to attract wolves. First and foremost, they would do everything in their power to not let that happen. There are some facilities in Wisconsin that have habitual wolf problems. And in fact, the DNR lists 28 that are classified as chronic wolf depredation farms. So if wolves are delisted as is planned, I would expect that around the perimeters of those properties, the USDA agents and DNR will be working closely with the farmers to try to prevent additional depredations. And since now they'll have that lethal tool in their pocket, I would expect that they will use it. It has in the past shown that it is helpful and it can reduce depredations by taking out some of the animals that have just learned to turn to these captive facilities for their food. So that would be what I'd expect to see coming up. But to answer the caller's question, there are some facilities in the state that, because of where they're located, they have chronic wolf problems.
We've heard stories and perspectives like Jeff's and Lexi's repeatedly as we talk about this on the Ideas Network. What is the long-term goal here? What are we trying to accomplish?
Yeah, this is arguably the most challenging wildlife management task facing natural resources agencies, because you have, as we've just experienced in this short program, people from very different views. And one we haven't mentioned or heard a call from, but is the American Indian perspective. Our Ojibwe tribes in Wisconsin have an origin story that places the man beside the wolf, and it says that their fates are intertwined, and they don't want to see any killing of wolves. So it's a big challenge. But what we have now is a species that has shown that it can live in Wisconsin at numbers that were not thought possible and in different areas. So the Department of Natural Resources is going to have to try to balance these different perspectives and outlooks. I expect that it's going to be a years-long process.
Yeah, absolutely.
To come up with a plan. Yes.
Certainly. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Paul Smith is the outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We've been talking about delisting the gray wolf from the endangered species list. Halloween looked a little different this year. With uncontrolled COVID-19 spread across Wisconsin, many state and local health authorities warned against traditional trick-or-treating. Families still found ways to get in the spooky spirit. Madeline Fox talked to some of them about how they made Halloween work while sheltering at home.
For a mom of two, soon to be three, Melissa Rauch, this was supposed to be a particularly exciting Halloween. Her daughter Zelda turned two on October 30th, and her four-year-old son Grayson was finally old enough for trick-or-treating.
So I'm like, we'll go trick-or-treating, we'll do those kid haunted houses that they got, you know, all these costumes, that kind of stuff.
But COVID-19 activity is very high in Waukesha County, where they live, and nearly 1,000 students in the school district are quarantining because of possible coronavirus exposure. As a home health care worker, she didn't want to do anything that could risk spreading the virus to her clients. She sent in this audio of her solution.
All right, kiddos, you ready?
Mm-hmm.
You got your bags?
It just hit me like, we do Easter egg hunts during April. Why don't I get some goodie bags and hide them around the park where nobody's at usually, and I'll let them find the candy themselves. They can wear their costumes, they can have their bags, they can have some sort of experience and not have to potentially be exposed with all these other families.
Zelda, why don't you look over here?
Zelda, that's grass. That's not candy.
Waukesha allowed trick-or-treating, and some experts said it could be modified to be relatively safe. Malia Jones is an epidemiologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She told WPR's The Morning Show about some ways to reduce risk.
Using tongs or grabbers to hand out the treats, wearing a mask. The kids should also be wearing a mask that covers their nose and face.
Still, the state suggested that families skip going door-to-door and other Halloween gatherings if they could. Here's Governor Tony Evers the day before the holiday.
As we head into Halloween weekend, a time when many would normally be out and about in a different sort of face mask, please stay home. Avoid any in-person parties or get-togethers. Don't go to other homes or have people in your own home who are outside of your immediate households.
The Thompson-Martinez family of Appleton kept their celebration to just the 8 members of their immediate family, 2 parents and 6 kids ranging from 4 months old to 13 years.
We have 3 boys, 3 girls, so kind of like the Brady Bunch a little bit.
That's their mom, Jen, who also thought about a Halloween candy hunt.
The boys vetoed that. They're like, I don't want to have to go out and find it. And I'm like, well, what about hiding it in the house and make clues? And they're like, no, just give us the candy. I'm like, fine. Jeez.
They played games of Loteria, a Mexican card game similar to bingo, competing for candy. They ordered their costumes on Amazon, a Grim Reaper, a pineapple, a witch, and more. Other classic Halloween traditions also adapted. Rainbow Booksellers in Milwaukee made its Halloween costume contest virtual by having participants email in pictures for prizes. Here's Mae McCulley, who helped organize it.
We're seeing some of the same, we're seeing some new ones, and we're seeing some really nice creativity, which is a lot of fun. You know, people are being creative. They're not just coming in their costume like they always have, but they're also kind of setting their scene for their photo.
Some cities that canceled trick-or-treating offer drive-in Halloween movies, and Malia Jones with UW-Madison says some traditions were already more COVID-friendly.
Haunted forests are fine. That's outdoors. You can keep your group small, keep your distance from other people, and wear a mask. You know, corn mazes, pumpkin patches are all okay, too.
With new cases and hospitalizations likely to remain high through the end of the year, Halloween COVID style may offer a blueprint for the winter holidays. Small gatherings, new traditions, and not losing sight of the important things, family and sweet treats. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. We know airports are not seeing nearly as much traffic due to the pandemic, but some innovation and updates are still happening. Previously on Central Time, we've learned about a pilot project for small-scale farming using indoor hydroponic technology. That same organization running the project, Appleton-based Fork Farms, has now teamed up with the Appleton International Airport. To tell us more about what's going on at the airport, we have Patrick Tracy, Marketing Manager for Appleton International Airport. Pat, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Keely.
So you're growing food inside the airport. That's not usually where we would expect to grow food. What does the setup look like?
It's beautiful. The actual flex farm is 5 feet tall. It's about 3 or 4 feet wide. And it emits this beautiful, bright white light. And you can see the little lettuces kind of poking their heads out of their little growing cylinders. And it's very eye-catching on our airport concourse.
So people can see this if they are using the airport?
Yes, they can. We have it literally right next to our restaurant on the concourse. So as people would queue up to buy their little to-go sandwiches or, you know, wait to get coffee, you pass right by our flex farm and you get to look into it and kind of see what's happening. It's a conversation starter.
A conversation starter that had to start with some sort of conversation. I mean, who came up with the idea to grow food that you would serve at the airport in the airport?
Back in April when we were putting together our COVID response, and it, you know, back then we didn't really know what we were doing, so we were kind of making it up as we went along. And our phrase is making healthy connections fly. The Appleton Airport has a big partnership with ThetaCare, and we've had healthy messages and hand sanitizing for a couple of years in Appleton. And as we were thinking about how could we make the experience even safer for our travelers in the COVID times, somehow we hit upon the idea of making our food fresher, and I had become aware of the Flex Farm product, and it just seemed like a fun thing to do to bring some joy to our customers.
Who actually manages the growing chambers or pods, or what's the terminology here?
It's a hydroponic farm. That's kind of what I call it. And so it's a partnership. We have an amazing restaurant manager that runs our restaurants at the airport, Stacy. She's just wonderful. She's in there every morning at 5 a.m., knows all of our customers by name. And so she's been appointed our resident farmer to keep an eye on the farm.
And what are you growing?
Fresh greens. We have a variety of nice, fresh sandwich greens. And right now, our farm will grow 300 pounds of fresh greens a year, which is enough for us to use on all of our sandwiches and burgers that we serve at the airport.
And how long did it take to get this all up and running then?
We started talking about it in April, and we got serious about it in July. And we've had the unit for 2 weeks now, and we'll harvest our first fresh greens next week.
Wow. Is this more sustainable? Is it saving the airport money? Both? Neither?
It's all of the above. The Appleton Airport was selected a few years back as one of the USA's sustainability project airports. Appleton has a number of energy-saving features around the airport. Our short-term parking lot is covered with solar panels, so we actually produce enough energy to power our terminal on our own. We have a geothermal heat pump at our corporate area, our FBL, and we've done all the LED light replacements, so we are very focused on sustainability at the Appleton Airport, as well as giving our customers a great experience. And the Flex Farm just seemed like an opportunity to achieve both objectives.
What a cool site. Patrick Tracy, we'll have to check back with you sometime. Let us know how things are going and how things taste. Thanks for your time, Pat.
Thanks, Keely. Bye-bye.
Patrick Tracy is marketing manager for Appleton International Airport. And we talked about the fact that they're growing food inside the airport. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story about a woman trying to improve the health of Milwaukee.
How do you create a scary radio story during an already eerie time? Between the pandemic, social unrest, and the looming election, reality is unsettling enough for many people. Wisconsin Life's senior spooky correspondent, Aubrey Ralph, struggled with producing their annual horror story, yet brings us this tale.
As cold creeps in, the leaves drift down in swirls. Their dry, brittle bodies scurry, the skeletons of summer dancing their last hurrah. We gather here together in the dark around small fires or living rooms, sitting cross-legged on the floor. Take a sip of hot chocolate or brandy and pull your blanket tight as I tell you the story of...
What? Like getting a haircut? What am I going to make this piece about? We're in a global pandemic and I'm in the at-risk group. Scary movies are only fun because, like, when you leave the theater, no one's actually chasing you with a chainsaw. That Midsummer Festival was canceled. The Haunted Orphanage up north, well, they're not letting me in. Shouldn't travel anyway. What am I going to do? We had to replace a bunch of windows this year. That was terrifying. Maybe I could... Oh, great. Hi, Maureen.
Hey, Aubrey. How's your story coming along? Where are you on this?
Oh, it's going great. I'm almost...
Aubrey, I need this story before the end of the week. And as my senior spooky correspondent, I'm really counting on you.
Oh, okay. I promise. I guess I could do this about the dumb mirror thing. What do I need? A candle. A lighter.
in the bathroom, face the mirror, and just say the name three times. Bloody Mary. Bloody Mary. This is ridiculous. What am I, 9? I gotta get some air. My plan was to do this about all those teens who vanished 100 years ago tonight. It's like a block from my house, but of course there's no one here. Social media was going crazy about the anniversary back in February, and they got halfway through building the structure or altar or whatever it is. Some of the dolls are up, but after March, and supposedly you need 12 to form the circle to do the summoning, but there's no one here. At least they're being socially responsible. All right, back in the bathroom. May as well do this for real. In the age-old tradition, I stand here and face the mirror. I face the mirror and say the name 3 times. Bloody Mary. Bloody Mary. Bloody Mary. Well, that was uneventful. Wait.
Who dares to summon me?
No!
I have to finish my radio piece.
It's finished. It's finished. It's finished!
That's a magic number. Three. It is. It's the magic number.
Aubrey Ralph is, was, Wisconsin Life's senior spooky correspondent and the radio operations manager at WPR. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
That's a magic number.
You may have heard, there's an election tomorrow. WPR staffers in the newsroom and on the talk show side have been hard at work planning for that day and the days that follow. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What topics do you want to hear about in the days following the election? What aspects of the vote and the results do you want to learn about and get a chance to talk about, too? The number to call is 800-642-1234. Let us know. We've got Jay Carlisle Larson here. She's a Central Time producer, and she's coordinating tomorrow evening's live WPR election coverage as well. JC, thanks for taking the time to join us on a very busy day.
Hi, Keely.
And Noah Ovchinsky is WPR's news director. Noah, good to have you with us.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Keely.
Hey, Noah, what would Election Day coverage look like during a normal year?
Well, gosh, you know, what is a normal year? Normally, I think, you know, one of the biggest differences between, if not the biggest difference between this year and previous elections has been just the sheer number of absentee balloting that's happened both in Wisconsin and elsewhere across the country. And so it's probably going to take a little bit longer for us to hear results, you know, throughout Wisconsin and, you know, across the country. So I think it's more of a timing issue more than anything else. But like previous elections, we'll have reporters spread out across the state reporting on how things are going tomorrow.
And you'll still have reporters across the state reporting, but COVID-19 has changed some aspects of how you're covering things?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we take every reporting assignment and kind of do a risk assessment just because, you know, with the level of community infection happening right now around Wisconsin, there is a higher level of risk every time we send somebody out to interview people for our stories. But, you know, this is, you know, the biggest story right now. And so we feel like it's really our responsibility to tell Wisconsinites what's happening. And to do that, we need to be on the ground. We need to be at polling stations, observing, listening, seeing what's happening so that we can tell people how the election is going. So, you know, certainly our reporters will be, you know, obviously trying to keep their distance, 6 feet. They'll be wearing masks. But we're going to be out there, you know, doing the job, but doing so much more carefully than maybe years in the past.
All right. JC, let's talk about tomorrow evening. What time does NPR coverage begin, and when will we start having some Wisconsin-specific coverage?
Yeah, so NPR will start broadcasting here in Wisconsin at around 6 p.m. So if you are ready with your popcorn, get ready. It'll be at 6. And then starting at 8 o'clock or a little after 8, so the time that the polls close, that's when you'll start hearing from all of us. And it'll be a bit of a hybrid throughout the hours. You'll hear from both NPR and WPR throughout our coverage.
And who's hosting WPR coverage? Who will we hear from?
Yeah, so some people that longtime listeners will be familiar with, certainly on Central Time. Rob Ferret is back in the host seat. But this year, we're going to be joined in a bit of a different capacity by Sean Johnson, our Capitol Bureau Chief, and our State Capitol reporter, Laurel White. They'll be joining as co-hosts and as commentators. So it'll be a very conversation, not to be super redundant there, but they will be providing analysis throughout the evening, which is going to be a really interesting listener service because they have really in-depth knowledge of politics right here in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. And you've got some experts on deck, too. What type of people will be helping us put this into context?
So we're going to hear from the two leaders of the major parties of the state. So we'll have Andrew Hitt on from the Wisconsin Republican Party and Ben Wickler from the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Yeah. So they'll both be on. But we'll also be hearing from, you know, political scientists that many of us are familiar with, such as Barry Burden from the Elections Research Council, Lily Gorin. She is at Carroll University and will be providing, commentary on national issues throughout the night. But we'll also have, Angela Lang from Black Leaders Organizing Communities. It's also known as BLOC, to talk about, voter mobilization efforts in Milwaukee. So we'll be having really broad conversations with a lot of people in the state, including many of our WPR reporters who are covering various issues as well.
Yeah, it sounds really comprehensive. I do think one of the questions people have is how to decide when to call a race. Noah, what is the definitive source that your folks are looking to tomorrow?
Yeah, so we generally, Keely, that's a good question, and we generally defer to the AP. So the Associated Press for us is sort of the gold standard. When the AP calls a race, we then feel comfortable calling it. Typically, we try to use as much patience and discipline as we can. Sometimes it's hard to do, but the AP is really kind of our North Star when it comes to calling races.
And they have a whole team set up and a specific bar that they use to decide, okay, one person cannot catch up in this race, the other person won, right?
Yeah, exactly. AP has a huge team looking at this. And, that's not to say that there won't be other networks who may be calling races maybe earlier than we do. But for us, it's a matter of being really consistent and really comfortable with how the AP goes about their work. And so where, there may be a lag tomorrow between maybe NBC or ABC or CNN calling a race and us doing it. When we do it, you can rest assured, the audience can be rest assured, that we have a very high level of confidence to be able to make that kind of statement because the AP has made that statement.
Yeah, it's important to get it right. We're talking with WPR's news director, Noah Ovshinsky, also talking with producer J. Carlisle Larson, who's coordinating tomorrow evening's live election coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can let us know what you want to hear in the days and weeks ahead by calling 800-642-1234. Help us understand what's important to you as we go through Election Day and beyond. And JC, regardless of results that we do or don't have tomorrow evening, a lot of talk about on the Ideas Network talk shows on Wednesday and beyond. What can we expect from the morning show after the election?
Yeah, so I mean, to piggyback off of what Noah said, we will be waiting for the AP, and it is possible that we might not have a definitive answer, which is why the morning show and Central Time are going to be having really extensive coverage over the next few days. I'll just give a little sample just because there's a lot that we're covering. But on the morning show the day after, they're going to have John Greenbaum on. He is the chief counsel and senior deputy director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law. And that organization, they're in charge of 866 Our Vote, which is a national voter protection hotline. They will also be checking in with Shantae Nelson of the group All Voting is Local, just to learn more about what happened in the state. And then on Central Time, you know, we'll have David Cannon on as part of our regular Week in Washington segment to learn more about congressional races. We'll also have Laurel White on. She's going to, both her and Sean are going to be on both shows the following day. So if you miss them on tomorrow's coverage, you can hear them again. But we will really be covering this over the next, you know, certainly not just Wednesday, but several days following, just because we know that there's going to be a lot that is going to be developing over the next, you know, few days, weeks, et cetera.
Yeah. And there's so much there. We should mention, if people need a break from politics, we have some options during the midday on the Larry Mueller Show on Wednesday.
Of course. Yeah. If you also really do want a break and you just need to learn about some wildlife, Larry Mueller is going to be kind of your place that you want to stop. They're going to be talking about wildlife and wildlife in the winter. I know that I will probably be checking in as a palate cleanser and also just because I'm interested. So highly recommend checking in on Wednesday on the Larry Mueller Show.
Yeah, nice way to take the political hat off for just a little bit and listen to some good stuff from Larry there. Noah, moving forward past Election Day, what do you see news covering in these days and weeks?
Well, I think, Keeley, that's going to largely depend on, you know, where this election goes, whether or not we have a result, say, by Wednesday morning, or if, you know, there are some questions about, you know, states that may have their votes outstanding. So I think it's really hard to tell, to be honest with you. I wish I had a crystal ball, but we're going to be closely, the news department will be closely following the national election, as well as closely following and getting reaction to the races down ballot, both the state Senate, the congressional races, the state assembly here. It's not just about the presidential race. We'll be talking a lot about all of the down ballot races as well, both tomorrow and in the days to come.
And I assume Noah will also be talking about Wisconsin's role in that presidential election in these days and weeks.
Yeah, of course. I think, you know, we'll probably get our results Wednesday morning unofficially. So I think Wisconsin, I think, isn't going to be part of the larger story necessarily, just because there are other states that may take a little bit longer to count their votes. But certainly as a battleground, you know, our votes are important, and it'll be interesting to see where it all goes in the next 48 hours.
All right. Noah, thanks so much for catching us up on what news is doing.
Thank you. It was great to be here. Thanks, Keeley.
And JC, we really appreciate your time this afternoon.
Thank you.
J. Carlisle Larson is a Central Time producer, and she's coordinating tomorrow evening's live WPR election coverage. Noah Oshinsky is WPR's news director, and they joined us to give a preview of WPR's coverage on election night and beyond. Polls in Wisconsin are open tomorrow from 7 in the morning until 8 o'clock tomorrow night. We are now past the deadlines for voting absentee by mail and in-person absentee. If you do still have an absentee ballot, the Wisconsin Elections Commission wants you to return it as soon as possible. Don't put it in the mail. Take it directly to your municipal clerk's office or to a drop box location if you've got one nearby. And a final reminder that you can still register to vote at your polling place tomorrow in Wisconsin when you go to vote. You need to make sure that you bring the right materials and you're prepared. You can look up your registration status, your polling place, and more at myvote.wi.gov. We've got a link for you to that website at wpr.org/centraltime.